Hello, and welcome to the Critical Voter Podcast. My name is Jonathan Haber, and later in the show, we'll be joined by Simon Critchley, professor of philosophy at the New School and moderator of the New York Times philosophy column, The Stone. This promises to be an enlightening conversation, but before we get to it, I want to spend some time exploring the opposite end of the logical spectrum, but look at some of the fallacies we've seen during the election season. Earlier in this series, I promised that we would revisit the subject of fallacies, which represent either broken logic or flawed arguments or components of arguments, once the campaigns had thoughtfully provided examples of more of the 100-plus fallacies we haven't had a chance to discuss yet. Before diving in, however, I need to remind you something Kevin LaPlante from Critical Thinker Academy warned us about a few weeks ago when he noted that genuine campaign rhetoric, like the kind heard during the debates or in political speeches and ads, should not necessarily be judged by the standards of pure logic or argumentation designed to uncover greater truths. Scientists, scholars, and even philosophers like my upcoming guest have the luxury of engaging in dialogues of various types, including conversation, exchanges over research articles, and even debates, where all participants share a common goal of answering some question or getting to some truth. Which means I might be ready to forgo arguments from emotion and other forms of manipulative rhetoric, especially if using such manipulative techniques moved everyone further from that truth. Now, to cut politicians a little slack, I think it's fair to say that even philosophers and scientists are not beyond using tools of persuasion, including manipulative ones, up to and including bullying, to achieve victory, even at the expense of potential enlightenment. Scholars, after all, are human beings, and here in the real world, getting your ideas across, not to mention getting the biggest office in your academic department, takes more than just appeals to logic and to the better nature of your colleagues. So when it comes time to evaluate persuasive speech against standards such as the use of fallacies, we need to remember that presidential candidates engaging in debate, for example, are not working together on a scholarly project, leveraging an adversarial system to answer a common question. Rather, as Kevin pointed out, they're engaging in a type of performance designed to accomplish other goals, such as inspiring their political base, reaching out to undecided voters, and not making an error that can be used against them in the next TV ad. So judging them by the same standards you would use to judge a Socratic dialogue would itself represent fallacious thinking on our part. In fact, it would represent what's called a category error, one in which standards relevant to one category of things are applied to something that does not fit into that category. For example, since murder is defined as the intentional killing of another person, then someone might be tempted to conclude that every soldier that kills someone in combat must be a murderer. But this would be a category error since, at least for most of us, we put soldiers doing their military duty into a different category than the guy bumping off his wife for her insurance money. Category errors like this are variants on the composition fallacy we talked about back in episode 5. This is the fallacy where you mistakenly assign attributes of one member of a group to the group as a whole, such as, Joe is a member of the Democratic Party and Joe is left-handed, therefore Democrats are all lefties. Actually, this last example also illustrates another fallacy called equivocation, which is using a word that has more than one definition, in this case lefty, to try to intentionally mislead. Sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. Okay, I just pointed out that condemning this year's presidential candidates for their use of fallacies might itself be a fallacy. Remember that this podcast is not about evaluating the candidates to help you decide whom to vote for. Rather, we're using the materials provided to us by the campaigns to illustrate various critical thinking principles. And fortunately for us, the language of an election usually provides ample material for us to go mining for fallacies. So let's start digging. Back when we were talking about the first presidential debate, I mentioned that both candidates were using argumentation from authority and trying to give their economic proposals weight by claiming that they were supported by one or six reports, presumably reports written by experts in the field of economics. Now, such appeals to authority do not necessarily rise to the level of fallacy, especially if these reports exist, were written by experts, and actually say what the candidates claim they say. But an appeal to authority does become fallacious when, for example, the authority being appealed to is respected in one field but is commenting on a subject outside of his or her expertise. For instance, a Nobel Prize-winning physicist has tremendous authority in the field of physics. But if they decide to make pronouncements regarding political matters, such as a war and peace or what constitutes a fair tax code or national healthcare system, those pronouncements should be taken no more seriously, although certainly no less seriously, than those made by any other really smart person. Also, if an authority is speaking within his or her field of expertise, if his or her opinions represent a dramatic break from consensus within that field, then you're committing a fallacy if you don't alert your audience to that fact. This doesn't mean that your expert's maverick opinion might not be correct, Most great breakthroughs, after all, come from people willing to buck consensus. But if you want to avoid committing another authority-related fallacy, you need to clearly identify that your authority is a bold and independent thinker, not a representative of mainstream thought. An argument from authority is part of a group of fallacies usually traveling under the name red herrings. These are fallacious arguments designed to distract the audience from what it should be thinking about, and it's the type of fallacy you probably saw most frequently in both the presidential and vice presidential debates. For example, during the vice presidential debate, Joe Biden clearly did not want to have to answer the first question about a brewing controversy regarding the administration's handling of an attack on the American embassy in Libya. So in his 346-word response, he mentioned the killing of Osama bin Laden, which his boss should be praised for, wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which Obama should be praised for ending and Romney condemned for trying to extend, and tracking terrorists to the gates of hell, but never seemed to get around to responding to what was being asked of him before the clock ran out. You saw the same thing during the second presidential debate, when Mitt Romney had to answer a question regarding gun violence, specifically violence that could be attributed to powerful assault weapons like the AK-47. Just an aside, most people have no idea what an AK-47 is or looks like, but it's such a threatening-sounding name that it serves as an effective stand-in, or, as Jay Heinrichs told us last week, a schenectady for all weapons we think should not be on the street. Oh, and on the street is a trope. A phrase used to turn an amorphous but more accurate phrase such as widely available into something more concrete. Sorry, where was I? Oh yes, Romney and guns. When responding to this question, which clearly had to do with the governor's opinion on federal gun control laws, Romney quickly brought the subject to safer territory, including the need for better schools and the importance of two-parent families, which caused one Facebook wag, my brother in fact, to question whether or not more marriage might lead to more gun violence. Now, red herrings are so common in today's political arguments that I need to highlight a subtle but important distinction that needs to be kept in mind. As we saw in the debates, particularly in the second presidential debate, candidates want to use these occasions not to actually mix it up with their rivals or answer questions put to them by the moderators or audience members, but rather to insert key talking points they prepared in advance into a conversation. Some debaters are actually quite skilled at making their prepared text sound like answers to questions being asked, but as was obvious during the recent town hall-style debate, neither Mitt Romney, who brought every question back to unemployment and the economy, or President Obama, who used each question as an occasion to attack his opponent's consistency and honesty, are particularly good at this trick. As usual, the humor paper The Onion summed up the phenomena best in an article headlined, "Town Hall Attendees Still Standing Patiently Waiting for Their Questions to Be Answered," which described questioners still hanging around the hall 15 hours after the debate ended, question cards in hands, waiting to get a straight response from the candidate who long ago left for the next fundraiser. As tempting as it would be to categorize every response each candidate gave as a red herring fallacy, assuming that any attempt to change the subject or shift the agenda of a conversation to be fallacious is another category error. For not all such shifts are of the "don't look at that man behind the curtain" variety. In fact, many times, these are reasonable ways of avoiding questions that themselves represent fallacies. For instance, loaded questions usually represent a kind of false choice or false dilemma, where someone is given a narrow set of options to choose from, any one of which would make them look bad. You saw this in the second debate, when Mitt Romney repeatedly asked his Democratic rival how much he cut permits and licenses to drill for natural gas on federal land. Since any direct answer to such a question, which would have to come in the form of a percentage, would establish the accuser's key point, that the Obama administration had cut rather than increased the availability of such permits, the president's decision to avoid giving a straight answer to such a question is perfectly reasonable and should not be considered a fallacy. The type of gotcha journalism that both candidates have repeatedly been subjected to also represents situations where not giving a direct response simply means not falling into the trap a reporter is set by asking a no-win question while the television cameras are rolling. A good example of this was when Mitt Romney was asked the same question 6 times, apparently by reporters who had coordinated their efforts to back him into a corner, regarding his response to the recent crises in Libya and Egypt. In such cases, avoiding direct response is not only not fallacious, it represents a perfectly logical and valid way of handling a difficult rhetorical situation. Genuine red herrings can be distinguished from simple subject changing when they're used to avoid a genuine issue, especially when they appeal to something other than logic in order to do so. For instance, most appeals to bad emotions such as bigotry, fear, hatred, ridicule, and spite represent red herrings, as do questioning the motives of your opponent or engaging in some other type of ad hominem attack. Ad hominem translates to the man, and involves an assault on the character, history, or behavior of the arguer as a way of avoiding his or her argument. This is a favorite technique for TV talk show hosts who never tire of dragging skeletons out of the closet of those they don't agree with and whose questions they'd rather not answer. And speaking of cable TV, it's time to get to my favorite red herring fallacy of all, the argument from outrage. This is one where the arguer bursts into fury at the merest mention of any issue a person he or she dislikes, or any question he or she would like to avoid. The purpose of such, usually feigned outrage, is to raise the emotional temperature so high that rational discourse cannot continue, presuming it ever started in the first place. We've seen this technique used by politicians, not just the media. While I've tried to use bipartisan examples whenever possible, the behavior of Vice President Joe Biden in the one and, thank goodness, only vice presidential debate was such an over-the-top use of argumentation from outrage, one which left Biden shouting, interrupting, and eye-rolling, the only thing anyone remembers from the encounter, that I'm currently encouraging a video of his performance to replace definitions for this technique in all fallacy directories from now on. At first, I kind of despaired when looking at some of those directories of fallacies I just mentioned, wondering how we'd ever get to even a fraction of them during the course of the short series of podcasts. But in going over them with an eye towards the less obscure ones we are most likely to encounter during a political race or in daily life, struck me we've actually gotten pretty far. In addition to the ones mentioned or referenced on today's show, don't forget the mathematical fallacies we discussed a couple weeks ago, including cherry-picking, a fallacy involving selective use of evidence, and comparing apples to oranges, a version of the false analogy. These are both what are known as false or faulty generalizations, and include other errors such as the hasty generalization, coming to a conclusion based on too little evidence, or fallacies that ignore important exceptions to a rule someone is arguing for, or make so many self-serving exceptions to that rule that the rule no longer works as a general principle. Something you might have noticed with all these examples is that none of them involve breaking the formal rules of logic, such as the classical broken syllogism, all dogs are animals, Francine is a dog, therefore all dogs are Francine. That's because in everyday conversation, people are more likely to engage in informal fallacies, fallacies based on the content of the statements they're making, versus formal fallacies, fallacies based on the logical structure of the argument. Not that politicians and others don't affirm a consequence, deny an antecedent, or engage in other fallacies related to formal logic. It's just that in most cases, content-related fallacies such as red herrings or faulty generalizations mean that even if their arguments are technically valid, i.e. they don't commit a formal logical fallacy, they're still unsound as a result of committing one or more informal ones. Now, I mentioned two groups of actors on the political stage who can be found guilty of using these informal and even formal fallacies on a regular basis, politicians and the media. But there's another party I've found to be even guiltier of committing each and every one of the fallacies on the longest list you could find on a daily basis. We the people. After all, it is we who love to see a candidate squirm under the spotlight, which is why we don't mind it if journalists engage in fallacious questioning or act in other illogical or unprofessional ways to service up a moment when we could squeal with glee at a candidate we don't like caught in a rhetorical trap, or savor a moment of outrage when we see the same thing being pulled on the candidate we prefer. It's also we voters who fall for negative TV ads made up of cut-and-pasted snippets featuring flubs the candidates made during a debate, only turn around and lambaste these same candidates for playing it safe during those debates by giving stock responses versus engaging in genuinely spontaneous dialogue. From the earliest days of internet debate, anyone else out there remember Usenet? Supporters of particular candidates, parties, or causes have utilized each and every fallacy ever created to promote their cause and condemn their enemies, a process that has only expanded now that almost every political website contains a comment section where people can post their critiques, opinions, and tirades anonymously. In addition to all the common fallacies we've been talking about, these open forums are where you'll get the chance to see some more colorful but obscure ones in action, such as the perfect solution fallacy, also called a nirvana or utopia fallacy. Totalitarians are particularly fond of combining this fallacy with a double standard, insisting that democracies be judged by their flaws, i.e. how they have failed to create perfect societies, combined with an insistence, often delivered using argumentation from outrage, that their own brutal regimes be judged based solely on their theoretical goals of creating such perfection. Online forums are also where I regularly encounter one of my favorite named fallacies called No True Scotsman. This one is based on the story of a Scotsman who reads on page one of his newspaper about a brutal murder in England who declares, "No Scotsman would ever do such a thing," who then turns the page to read about an even more brutal murder that just took place in Scotland and declares, "No True Scotsman would do such a thing." If you want to see this in action, just tune into the comments section of a major news site, which will be filled with true Scotsmen the minute an act of violence occurs within any national, ethnic, or religious community. One of the reasons the internet is filled with so many lists of fallacies is that since the beginning of internet debate, partisans have routinely tried to educate readers as to the nature of fallacies, primarily to demonstrate how guilty their opponents are of using them. While anything that promotes the teaching of critical thinking subjects, including fallacies, should be welcomed, think for a moment how many principles of critical thinking such self-serving condemnations violate. First, there's an implied accusation that one's opponents are not making any legitimate points, but are simply engaging in fallacious argumentation. And while such accusations might be true, it's been my experience that such partisans are far stricter with regard to scrutinizing their opponents' arguments for fallacies than their own or those of their supporters. Second, since a complex argument or set of arguments might include one or more errors, including one or another named fallacy, it's too easy to hold a fallacy you've discovered up high and declare your opponent's entire position to be illegitimate, as opposed to having simply found a flaw in it. In other words, this represents the same pouncing on your opponent's weakest points versus taking on his or her strongest ones that the principle of charity tells us we should never do, at least if we want to be truly critical thinkers. Finally, identifying your opponent's fallacies, or figures of speech for that matter, by name is just pretentious, especially if you use the Latin handles for these fallacies or devices, and usually just serves to convince your audience that you're a dweeb, rather than right. And speaking as someone who has just spent the last several minutes proving his own dweebiness, I recommend that you use your knowledge of fallacies as you're using the knowledge of Aristotle's modes of persuasion, the canons of rhetoric, figures of speech, and other tools we've learned over the last several weeks as the means to understand what others are doing to try to persuade and perhaps trick and manipulate you. And rather than call them out on this or that name fallacy, you should simply use the valid, sound, and persuasive arguments you now know how to construct to smash your opponent's fallacious ones, without anyone needing to know what's going on behind the scenes. And with that, it's time to welcome our guest, Professor Simon Critchley, to Critical Voter. Professor Critchley is the Hans Jonas Professor of Philosophy at the New School in New York, who's written extensively on the subjects of philosophy, literature, and ethics. Over the last several years, he has also served as moderator for The Stone, a regular column in the online version of the New York Times that looks at issues of the day through the lens of philosophy and cognitive science, including many of the topics longtime Critical Voter listeners will be familiar with. Simon Critchley, welcome to Critical Voter.
Thank you very much.
Simon, can you tell us something about yourself and about The Stone? And what went into the Times' decision to run a regular column on philosophy?
Well, I teach philosophy at the New School in New York. And about 4 years ago, I did a book called The Book of Dead Philosophers, which was an account of how philosophers die, amongst other things. And that wound its way into the opinion editor at the New York Times, who liked it and then asked me to write for the Times. And so I began to do some pieces in the op-ed page from about 2009 onwards on the online opinion page. I got to know an editor there called Peter, and we became friends. We lived close to each other in Brooklyn. And, you know, we were having all best ideas. It began in a bar over a drink, and we were talking about different things. And then we had the idea of maybe a philosophy column would work. And that's really how it began. And then it was launched in May 2010. So it's been running for 2.5 years now, nearly. So it's, you know, with a break of about 6 months, it's been very interesting. I mean, I wasn't sure whether it would work. It's worked pretty well. And the Times like it because it doesn't really cost much money and they get quite a lot of readers. So they're pleased too. It's been surprising the amount of readers we've got for philosophy. And it's also been surprising the turns it's taken in terms of who's written for it and which pieces have taken off and which pieces haven't taken off.
Can you tell us more about the response to the series? It sounds like there were some surprises with regard to who turned out to be interested in the subject.
Yeah, it began before the New York Times introduced their subscription wall, which was introduced, I think, in 2011. That development cut the number of readers for the Times online because they have to pay money. But there are ways of getting around that wall if you're clever. When we launched, we were getting large audiences of about, you know, 500,000 to 1 million in some cases. And then over a period of time, those numbers would increase. Some pieces would keep being read. After the subscription wall, initially, the audiences were lower, but still huge by any academic measure. A piece I did, for example, on Mormonism, which came out a month ago now, has been the most viewed piece on the Times over the last month. And that has got an audience of about, I don't know, 750,000, something like that. So we're talking about, I mean, by philosophical standards, huge numbers. So that's been gratifying. And it's the response is overwhelmingly not from academics. Academics read it, but they don't comment because, well, that's for them to say. But it's mainly ordinary people out there who often they've been to college. Often they have done some philosophy at some point. Often they haven't. And they're scattered all over the country and all over the world. But there'll be, you know, a Jack from Georgia and a Jill from South Carolina or something. And people regularly comment. It's really dispersed in terms of its range. But the most interesting thing is to look at the comments and look at what these pieces provoke in readers. That, for me, is often the most fun part.
Stone has run a number of articles this year focusing on politics and the election, right? And assuming those are what has driven the most traffic and comments?
Well, yes and no. That's sometimes the case, but often you'll find that we've run really abstract pieces. For example, there was a piece in the first series on the logic of paradoxes by the sort of world's foremost expert in that area, which got a huge readership. And often moral issues get a lot of play. But yeah, the political ones have been timely and got a large response. I think what's changed when we originally conceived of The Stone, it was conceived of as philosophy behind the headlines. And to some extent it's been that, but to some extent it's just been, as it were, straight pieces of philosophy done by people that know what they're talking about in a jargon-free way, and people want that. There's enormous hunger for good stuff done by clever people that doesn't patronize its audience. And they don't really care whether that person is ridiculously famous or not. One thing we found is that we've had pieces by very famous people which have done well or not so well, and pieces by pretty obscure people that have done fantastically well because the topic just interests readers. So readers are interested in quality, and they're not really so interested in who's saying it.
Of the pieces you've run, any of the covered election-related issues that either struck a chord or a raw nerve?
Well, as the Mormonism piece went ballistic, it took me a week just to deal with the aftermath of it, a lot of which came from very devout Mormons. It was fascinating. I collected all the responses and was following the story sort of rebound in Mormon newspapers and whatever. That was, from a personal point of view, very interesting to watch because I was looking into the sort of deep theology of Mormonism, which nobody talks about. But the piece, I guess, that really stands out recently was a piece by a philosopher called Jason Stanley, who teaches at Rutgers, which is called, I think, Speech, Lies, and Apathy. And it's a very interesting piece. And he makes the point, which I think is very important, that a misunderstanding of contemporary politics, or maybe the major misunderstanding of contemporary politics, is that politicians are making assertions about which the truth or falsity of those assertions can be decided. He shows fairly convincingly that in a lot of cases, the question of truth or falsity is not really the issue. It comes down to a question of rhetoric and force and speaking to a certain constituency that want to hear what is said. So there's a kind of stalemate that we've reached in political discussion, which is that politicians say things and we can fact check them. It's not that that's wrong, but it's not the whole picture. You know, it overlooks questions of rhetoric, persuasion, force, the appearance of authenticity and sincerity, and all the rest. And what I think Romney did particularly effectively in the first debate was just decide to say things that, in a sense, were not empirically provable, but if they were said with enough conviction, they were convincing. And that leads us to some rather alarming conclusions, I think.
Sounds like you're saying something similar to what last week's guest pointed out, which is that people respond at least as much to rhetoric-driven emotional and ethos appeals as they do to logical ones. I guess the piece you just mentioned reinforces the notion that logic alone can't drive our decision-making.
And nor should it, in my view. I think people interested in politics should be students of rhetoric, and rhetoric is a hugely interesting area. It's something that's a rather impoverished area of study. I mean, rhetoric is the study of speech, which can move the audience, right? Literally, I mean, you know, the origins of that, to some extent, lie with the English Parliament, where if you could speak with real conviction about a topic, you could move the listener, produce an emotion that produced motion, literal motion, and they cross the floor and join the other party. So politics is about rational arguments very often. It's about facts, but those things have to be shaped and deployed in rhetoric. And, you know, what we see in, particularly in the presidential debates, there's a certain relationship to truth going on, but it's insignificant in relationship to rhetorical effects, the ability to memorize what appear to be long lists of facts, and to produce a blow in words that will defeat your opponent. These things are very important, and I would urge students of politics to study them. For me, the great tradition here includes people like Quintilian and Cicero and Hobbes, who urged students of politics to study rhetoric as well as philosophy, and I agree with that.
The experience I've had talking with people since the election started, it really seems as though the lost art of rhetoric has left people a little bewildered, possibly at the mercy of people who haven't chosen to ignore the subject.
Yeah, and this is where, in terms of your critical thinking skills, it can be very, very important. But it's also quite alarming because you realize that political speech is about creating the illusion of authenticity, the illusion of sincerity, the illusion of truth. And we know that. We're not stupid. We know that when Clinton spoke at the Democratic National Convention and so many people were moved by what he said, they know it. It's a rhetorical ploy, but it's just a particularly convincing rhetorical ploy. And we applaud him because he's a very good rhetor, which is what the Greeks would have called him. He's someone who can persuade. And part of the complaint about both Obama and Romney is that they're relatively poor rhetoricians in comparison to, say, someone like him. So it's not that we're dumb or we're duped. We know what's going on, but we don't necessarily have the tools to analyze it. It's not just a question of truth and falsity. It's a question of a much more complex set of skills which we need to deploy in order to criticize and analyze what's taking place in the world.
So, Simon, in addition to looking at rhetoric and other relatively ancient subjects, I know the Stone has also covered subjects related to cognitive science. Any thought on the role our brains play in some of the things we've been talking about?
The brain, I'm not really a brain guy. In the 19th century, people were obsessed with phrenology, right? They were convinced that bumps on the head could allow us to explain forms of behavior. And there have been similar fads historically. Our current obsession is with the brain. We have brains, and they're very, very nice. And I'm very pleased we have brains, and brains are necessary for cognitive processes and thinking and such like. But for me, as it were, thinking is not something that goes on in the head. Thinking is something that goes on outside the head. We have this idea of thinking as something, you know, inside your skull. Thinking is a social activity. It's a shared activity. And that's what language is. Language is something like we're speaking to each other. And we're speaking to each other to a virtual community that we hope listens to what we say. It's a shared social practice. And there's a kind of obsession with finding forms of determination in the brain, which is not that I think that's wrong. But again, that's just part of the picture. We're never going to find anything in the brain which is like an, oh, aha, and finally we understand. The penny drops. The mystery is solved. Just ain't going to happen.
I can't tell you how many times people have told me I need to read the book The Republican Brain. I'm sure some partisan brain scientist is currently working on a rejoinder on the Democratic Brain, which I guess is supposed to prove that yet another social construct, in this case party affiliation, is actually a matter of physiology.
Exactly. It's just the wrong place to look. We need to look at society. Much more important than the brain are things like sociology or political science or rhetoric or linguistics, you know, how language is used, how it's shaped. And most important of all for me is history. All of these things, society, politics, language, take shape on a historical landscape. And the greatest weapon that a critical thinker can have is a knowledge of history. There's a statement by, I think, Goethe, where he says, a man that does not have 400 years of history under his belt is impoverished. Now, that's a rather grand claim, but history is a weapon. And you realize that more history you understand, the less surprised you are by things that happen, because you realize how much things are inclined to repeat from one generation to the next. We live in societies that cultivate amnesia. So for me, the most important single area of human activity is the study of history.
And while you're on a roll with recommendations for listeners, what else would you recommend people who have been introduced to subjects like philosophy through study of critical thinking do next?
My advice is read until your eyes hurt. Read consecutively, read laterally. Also to read slowly and critically and just absorb as much as you can. Now, I think to come back to the question of politics, I think a problem in our understanding of politics is that politics for us is a kind of spectator sport. We can sit there and watch a debate like spectators in a theater and make a judgment as to who won or lost. And if we think that is the be-all and end-all of politics, then I think we're really deluded. Politics is not about being a spectator or contemplating in that sense. It's about action and engagement in the creation of something which can be genuinely surprising. Why, this time last year, during Occupy, there was suddenly a large number of people who were engaged in a new form of politics that wasn't about watching TV and having a view one way or the other or deciding which way you were going to vote, but was about associating and participating. For me, politics has always been about engagement and action rather than contemplation. So we need those critical thinking skills. We need them as honed as sharply as possible. But it mustn't lead to an impoverishment of the level of action, which is really what's important for me. And so in a sense, there's a kind of a risk in, particularly in American political culture, of everything being reduced to a kind of spectacle that we can critically judge one way or the other. And politics is actually more important than that.
Well, Simon, thanks so much for joining us. It's been an extremely interesting conversation.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Simon Critchley, professor of philosophy at New York's New School and moderator of the New York Times online column, The Stone. And presuming that you're aching to start in on Simon's suggestion that you read and familiarize yourself with both philosophy and history, I'd like to close this week's show with a book recommendation that will allow you to accomplish all these goals at once. Back when I first introduced Aristotle's Modes of Persuasion, I mentioned my regret that we would not have time to dive more deeply into some of the philosophy or history topics our guest just mentioned, given the amount of other critical thinking material we needed to cover in a relatively short amount of time. To make up for that shortcoming, I posted links on the Critical Voter Resources page to books and other material you could turn to if you're interested in studying these important subjects further. And one of the books on that list happens to be my favorite read so far this year, The Dream of Reason by Anthony Gottlieb. The book is a survey of Western philosophy from the ancient Greeks through the Renaissance, which ends just at the dawn of modern philosophy, which will be the subject of a second volume of the series the author is currently working on. Gottlieb, who's best known as the former executive editor of the British periodical The Economist, also, like today's guest, taught at the New School and is a contributor to the New York Times. Well, you can find other easier on-ramps to this material in the form of Philosophy for Dummies or Beginners books or some Aristotle in 20 Minutes website. Gottlieb's Dream of Reason provides a remarkable sweep of in-depth coverage of both philosophers and philosophy without ever losing the benefits of humor and accessibility. In case you're asking yourself whether you really need to learn any more philosophy than the limited amount we've used here to master important critical thinking skills, keep in mind that if you've ever studied anything in the past, that you've already been involved with the study of philosophy. For as Gottlieb points out in his introduction to Dream of Reason, every academic field originated as a branch of philosophy, which is why we still award doctorates of philosophy, or PhDs, to people studying subjects as diverse as quantum physics or Jungian psychology. But once a branch of philosophy becomes fruitful enough to break off as a separate discipline, physics and psychology being good examples of this phenomena, it doesn't take long for practitioners of these supposedly new fields, such as physicists and psychologists, to forget their roots and mock philosophy as impractical, whose practitioners have their heads permanently stuck in the clouds. An accusation first directed at Socrates, by the way, in a stinging Greek comedy called The Clouds. So to all of you busy studying practical subjects like marketing, an offshoot of psychology, which is an offshoot of philosophy, or computer programming, which is nothing more than the latest iteration of Aristotle's logic, won't do your mind, or likely your career any harm, to familiarize yourself with the roots of everything you are learning or will likely ever learn. And with that recommendation, it's time to sign off for this week. Join us next week when we'll be taking a look at both sides of everything, when our guest will be Kamia Caven, President and Managing Editor of the ultimate fair and balanced informational website, procon.org. I look forward to talking to you then on the next Critical Voter Podcast.